It's time for conversations about our food and how it's grown on Farm to Table Talk with your host, Roger Wasson.
Well, many of us think about the future of farming, and in some cases, it's showing up as a subject for articles and speeches and presentations, and most recently, national publication, The Nation, in fact, is featuring the future of food, setting the table for the next generation. And I'm happy to have Zoe Carpenter, who is an associate Washington editor with The Nation magazine, with me today. Zoe has previously been with Rolling Stone, has appeared on MSNBC, CNN, and now after all of those, Zoe, you can add Farm to Table Talk to that impressive list. when people say, well, where have you been? Well, CNN, Farm to Table Talk. Zoe, welcome to Farm to Table Talk.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm happy to join you.
You know, I want to start off with, from a magazine like The Nation, you have a self-described image of being a progressive magazine. Is that fair to say? I'm pretty sure I've seen you it referred in the magazine itself as a progressive perspective.
One of our mottos or taglines is instigating progress since 1865. So I think we're quite comfortable with that designation.
Did you say since 1865?
That's correct. We are the oldest weekly magazine that's still publishing in the United States.
Well, that's interesting because in some respects, I think some of the agriculture that's becoming more in favor is almost the kind of agriculture we had in 1865, using livestock, using rotations, and in fact, it was organic then, but we didn't know it. And we've kind of gone full cycle in the last 150 years or so. When your perspective right now as a progressive national weekly magazine that's been in business for longer than anybody, how does food and farming end up being a priority for you to dedicate much of a whole issue on the subject? How did that come to be?
Well, I think at the most basic level, you know, food is a priority for everyone. We can't live without it, which is sort of an obvious statement. But because it's so central to all of our lives, it means that a lot of the big debates we're having about politics and about economics and about culture are related to food or get reflected in the conversations that we have about food. And so when we were, you know, thinking about this issue, one of the things that we wanted to focus on was the fact that this is a time of great uncertainty within our food system. And some of these big changes that are rocking other areas of our life, related to technology, related to political power, related to corporate power, those things all affect the food system. And so it seemed worth exploring that in a variety of specific ways.
You know, I want to get back to this origin of the idea for the issue, too. So when you do this, is this months ago that several of you and other editors and writers are sitting around a conference table with a whiteboard and putting up ideas? I mean, how does this start, this generation of this idea take place?
Well, it's pretty close to what you just described. I certainly was not the only person working on this issue. We had several brainstorming meetings with the editorial staff to think about what our priorities be, what sorts of issues do we want to cover, what kinds of voices do we want to have in the magazine, what was the range of tones. And I think one of the things that was important to us is that we had many very serious investigative and narrative pieces, but that there was also a bit of lightness and a bit of fun in the issue. And I would say a very important part of the process was working with our consulting editor, Anna LePay, who is a sustainable food expert and a widely respected author and speaker on food systems and sustainability. And so she provided us with some additional editorial support.
So you guys pick a time and say, let's send out the calendar invites. We're all going to get together at the table, and maybe Anna, because she's on the West Coast, perhaps she called in, and you have an agenda, and you start kicking around these ideas. I'm wondering, did you have any experience in the magazine based on previous articles that you've done on what your readership's interests were? Because I'm imagine you've had other food issues in the past.
Yeah, we looked at our past food issues. We've done, I think, four in the past decade or so. And, you know, I think our readers are interested in such a broad array of topics. So we really had plenty to choose from. And a lot of it was thinking about how our coverage areas, our regular coverage areas, things like labor, politics, environmental issues, how those overlapped with the food stories, because we know that our readers are already interested in those broader categories.
And when you do stories like that, the ones that you have out right now and then the ones you've had in the past, do you have a way to follow up and see what the readership is? Do you do surveys of your readership, or does your online offerings give you an indication of how one story is doing versus another story?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we track everything online, you know, through analytics to show us how many unique readers we have, you know, how much they're sharing an article, how much time they spend on it. So we can tell what topics are engaging readers, what's keeping them reading and sharing something rather than just opening it and then closing the page again.
A magazine is not just a magazine any longer. And
it's not, although we did really want to design this special issue to be a physical object. And so, you know, it was really rewarding to get the real hard copy magazine after months spent of thinking about this issue. And the design piece is important, and the cover is gorgeous. And so for me, I am technically a millennial, but I guess I'm sort of old-fashioned because I do find there to be something really special about seeing stories in print, especially when it's a whole package that is designed to go together, and that's really rewarding.
I love that graphic. I think it's very attractive. You ought to be selling T-shirts, too. I mean, it would it works really, really well. So I've actually read it. You were able to provide it to me online. I've read through the whole issue, enjoyed reading it, but I'm going to go look for a hard copy, too, at my bookstore because it's the sort of thing I think you really want to keep and have for a while. Let's talk about this issue and the subjects you got in. You had a really good column at the very beginning of this that talked about, you know, what are some of the uncertainties in the global food chain, of talking about how climate change and there's more and more people that are hungry and malnourished, and it looks like junk food is making its way into remote areas of Latin America and Africa, and they're getting more food, but they may be making them sicker. You know, having people that could be overweight and undernourished. You paint this broad picture of there's a lot of areas to be concerned. And again, to get back to this planning stage then, with Anna LaPay was the consultant with you, and you start identifying then each of these issues and then picking somebody to be the main writer of that story. How does that come about?
The assigning process varies depending on the story. Sometimes we have writers that pitch us a variety of stories, and we might choose among them. Other times we approach a writer with a topic and then sort of go back and forth trying to figure out what the narrative is that's going to illuminate that topic. So for this issue, it really varied. These pieces all came about in different ways.
But you wrote your summary after the whole thing was put together, I guess. So you had already made the assignments, and then you're writing the introductory piece of saying, here is our special food issue. You had a chance to see how this all came together. One of the first ones you led off with was about a grain that tastes like wheat but grows like prairie grass. Could you explain that story just a little bit?
Sure. Yeah, that's a feature by Madeline Ostrander, and she is looking at an effort to breed basically a better strand of wheat. And what I mean by better is that it is more environmentally friendly for the soil. And we're learning in recent years more and more about how vital the soil is, both in terms of the food that we grow, which seems rather obvious, but also for climate change. It turns out that a significant percentage of carbon is stored in the soil, and that our modern agricultural practices, specifically the amount at which we till up and turn over the soil, that releases large amounts of carbon dioxide into the atmosphere. It would be helpful if we could find new strands of some of our biggest commodity crops that didn't require the soil to be tilled so often. And that would help us with problems like, water conservation, as we look for how to deal with a warming planet, and especially when breadbasket regions across the world may be getting drier and approaching more desert qualities. And so this new strand of wheat called Kernza is a perennial, which means it grows back year after year. You don't have to till the soil and replant it each year. And its roots are much longer, so it can reach water that's further down. And the challenge is to try to make it tastier and to try to make it behave more like wheat when you cook and when you bake with it.
Well, that's a side of this story that I thought was really unusual, because I've heard of, all kinds of research before of looking at different types of grains. And this one is pretty unique, that you could have a perennial type of wheat grain that you can have that effect on reducing carbon. But the thing that was also interesting about this is it seemed like you had a restaurant into the story, too, that was actually taking some of that product and making dishes out of it. Did I get that right?
Yeah, that is right. You need to have partnerships between the scientists who are growing the grain and studying the genetics, and then the people who are actually going to be using the grain. And so there are a variety of bakers and beer makers and other people involved in the restaurant industry who are trying to work with these new grains and to give feedback to the scientists to say, well, it tastes too chalky, or my bread doesn't rise as much when I use this kind of wheat. And right now, with Kernza, I think most people are using it as a blend with the more conventional strains of wheat. I don't think most people are baking a loaf of bread with Kernza alone, but they have had much success blending it with other kinds of flours to make the delicious pastries and types of bread that we all love and enjoy. So it's an encouraging sign that we could have something that is both delicious and that really helps regenerate our soils and protect the climate.
Another thing that was surprising was the story that you had about Syrian refugees, that part of their, I think, adjusting to all that they're having to go through was finding comfort and their own culinary rituals. That was an unusual story. Very interesting.
Yeah, that was one of my favorites in the issue. And it's a really touching piece, and I think speaks to the way that cooking and eating together can really bring communities together. And, just to step back for a minute before I dive into the details of the story, as we think about the way that technology is changing food, I think one of the things that's happening is it makes food faster and more convenient, and we can eat on the go, and we can order our meals with one click ordering, and we don't even have to, proportion the ingredients ourselves. And that can be good and convenient for certain lifestyles, but I think it's also worth thinking about what we lose when we aren't participating in the cooking process together, if we're not dining with other people. That has played such a vital role in human communities for a long time. In the case of this story about Syrian refugees, it was reported from a Greek refugee camp called Rizona, and there was a collection of families from all over Syria, from all sorts of different educational, socioeconomic, religious, and ethnic backgrounds, who likely would not have socialized closely in Syria because of those differences. And they happened to find themselves living together in this refugee camp, basically trapped in Greece because other countries in Europe had sealed their borders and they didn't have any place else to go. And over the course of several months, the families gradually got to know each other through an effort to recreate the dishes from Syria that they missed. And they ended up becoming quite close and forming a communal kitchen where they shared equipment and shared ingredients. So it's, conditions were still very difficult for them, but it was at least a small link to home.
When you talk about that community, it's kind of surprising that the other community that you might talk about is the traditional Appalachian communities in the United States, and that you've talked about these areas of Appalachia that have been coal-based that might, in fact, be part of the new food movement, that they may have a future based on finding new ways to either produce or be engaged with local food production. That was a really surprising story to me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that was a story by Sarah Jones, who is from Appalachia, from, you know, the western, southwestern part of Virginia. She was writing about the history of Appalachian food, which is somewhat misunderstood. I think, you know, we think of Appalachia as being a very poor region, which is largely true. And we think of that as meaning that people eat quote-unquote trash, that, you know, quote-unquote white trash, people eat trash food. But there's really a rich and significant culinary tradition in Appalachia, which is very ingenious because people had to get by on very little. And a lot of the things that people eat in Appalachia historically were defined by the geography, which is more difficult because it's mountainous. And looking now at the post-coal landscape, there is an effort to revive some of these foodways and food traditions and bring back small-scale farming, as, along with restaurants and breweries and food hubs, to help to fill some of the gap that the collapse of the coal industry has left in the region.
You know, I think it'll surprise a lot of people because they tend to think that we're going to have the concentration of the most farm-to-table type of projects and programs and farm-to-school and food hubs and all these things. They expect them on both coasts, and they don't think about it in Appalachia. And this is, I think, another really interesting part of this whole issue that you draw attention to. These things are happening all over the place. And the thing I've noticed, Zoe, is that they don't happen in exactly the same way. I mean, I'm sure that what's evolving in the food movement in Appalachia is its own flavor. It's its own variety. It's not going to be the same thing that they do along the Hudson River in New York or what they might do in, you know, in the west coast of California.
Yeah, that's certainly true. And I think regional economies really matter a lot because if you're a farmer growing something, you know, in the Hudson Valley and you can get to green markets in New York City, you're probably going to be able to get a much higher price for your organic tomatoes than if you are growing them, you know, in somewhere in West Virginia in a very poor county where you can't expect people at farmers markets in those areas to be buying organic produce. I think there are different challenges depending on the region. There are obviously different crops that grow well in different areas. And then there's the question of land prices for someone who's trying to get into farming. For example, if you want to farm somewhere around Asheville, North Carolina, those property prices are probably going to be pretty high because that's where a lot of people like to have vacation homes, and there's a lot of tourist opportunities there. And so the competition for land will be much higher.
You know, one thing that didn't surprise me is that somewhere within this issue, Monsanto's mentioned. I was kind of glad to see it wasn't the whole feature. You know, it did get some reference as far as the controversies related to glyphosate. But I think the other part that where Monsanto was mentioned in this was talking about the consolidation of companies like Monsanto, not just them, but all the concentration that's taking place in the industry. And the meatpacking companies, in addition to the seed companies, and we've gone from hundreds down to two or three in some cases. And I thought you had a pretty good article that was raising the alarm of the concern of how there could be the negative impact of these monopolies that are taking place.
Yeah, this is one of the sort of hidden but immensely important trends in the agriculture industry. And if you talk to farmers, you know, this is very obvious to them, but I think to the average consumer, it might not be apparent how much just a few corporations control every single part of the food system, from seeds and pesticides up to meat, and then to the grocery stores or the grocery chains that sell the food back to us. So, for example, the top four meat companies now control 85% of the meat market. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, this has effects for both consumers who will face fewer choices and higher prices, but also for farmers. We have these contract systems where people who, let's say, raise chickens, there are only a few poultry producers that they can sell to. And so they're basically bound by whatever contract terms those few producers want to dictate because there's no competition or there's very little competition. And so when we first started putting this issue together and I was having conversations with people who are involved in agriculture and in farming, this is something that everyone wanted to talk about. It's just a really critical issue that farmers are facing. And it's something I think we should add that is sort of a sleeper political issue. And you know, Donald Trump came to power with a lot of support from rural communities, from farmers and agricultural communities. And something that would be very helpful to those communities is to start breaking up some of these monopolies. And yet the USDA under Trump's administration has gone in the opposite direction, has declined to step in. And so I think that that's something that people should be aware about when we talk about Trump's rural support.
You know, when you say that, it makes me think that, okay, you have identified an issue and you've already been self-described as a progressive publication. Is there a follow-up on issues like this for your magazine that you say that we've identified this is a troubling area of concern, that somewhere down the road you'll be following up with other stories, maybe suggesting a course of action or identifying somebody that is introducing legislation or, you know, supporting certain regulatory steps if they're heading the right direction? Do you have a next stage to get behind the identification of the issue to correction of what you would think has to happen to correct the problem?
Well, just to make sure I understand the question, do you mean a next phase for our coverage or a next phase?
Yeah, no, I meant for your coverage. I mean, when you do a story like this and you draw attention to the fact that there's a problem here, and so your readers see it and say, yeah, you're right, there's a problem here. Do you feel that you need to follow up on future issues to either track progress in the direction or maybe editorialize about promoting a way to correct the problem?
Yeah, we definitely plan to keep following these issues. And so often when we have big print features, say on, you know, the one on Monsanto and its herbicide Roundup, we hope that as that issue develops, it's related to a court case. So as that court case unfolds, the writer would maybe do a web piece for us that follows up when there are significant new developments. And of course, you know, we'll keep having regular coverage of climate change and some of these corporate issues related to consolidation and monopolies. And that's definitely a priority for us, is to continue to follow these issues as they unfold.
Well, when you are taking a certain approach, you're looking at issues that you think do need to improve. How do you manage to try to get some balance into the story itself? I would imagine that those that just assume that your publication is going to be against them, maybe they're not so quick to return your phone calls. I mean, even if you try to reach out and say, well, let's make sure we're getting all sides to express how they feel about this issue. Is that a problem, to try to even get feedback from people that have views that are usually different from yours?
In this issue, it was not an issue. For example, we had that big story on Monsanto and pesticides or herbicides, and the reporter was in touch with Monsanto and spoke with one of their spokespeople many times in preparing that story. And that's routine journalistic practice. You know, our mission and our charge as journalists is to report things accurately, not to follow an agenda. And so making sure that we touch base with Monsanto, for example, to hear how they respond to criticisms or allegations is a significant part of the process.
And they did return the phone call and talk to you?
Yes. That's great. Reporter spoke with their spokesperson multiple times.
As an editor, what's your job exactly? Because if you're not the one that's actually writing, doing most of the work on the story itself, what is it you do as an editor?
Well, it's a multifaceted job. So I was one of two co-editors on the issue, plus Anna LaPay. And then we had another editor who's on staff who worked on one of these stories. And so the job is from, you know, the sort of top level would be thinking about the whole arc of the issue, the range of that we have represented, the diversity of writers and voices that we bring to the page, and then, you know, what are some of the little features that we're going to sprinkle in. So, for example, you know, having cocktail recipes, that was something that we have never done before in the nation, as you can imagine. So we thought it would be fun to include some politically themed cocktail recipes. So part of my job is thinking creatively about that sort of thing to make the whole issue have character and flavor. And then, you know, as the articles get assigned and come in, then it's the sort of more typical editing process of working on the structure of a story, working with a writer to make sure they have all the sources that they need, polishing the language, putting headlines on, looking at photos. And of course, we work with a design team too to do the photos and layout and things like that. So it's really everything from that broad conceptual level down to how the article and the sentences themselves are put together.
And again, in this particular article, it would have taken place over a month or a couple months?
Yeah, a couple months, depending on the story. Anywhere from, you know, a month to 2 or 3 months, I think. We had the longest stories, I believe, are in the works for about 4 months for this issue.
Well, we know we've talked about the impact of these changes on farmers, on the processors, on communities, on areas of the country. One thing that I think that everyone listening could relate to is going out to eat and going to restaurants. And you also had a story there about thinking about how people are treated in restaurants. Talk about the other NRA, other than the National Rifle Association, the National Restaurant Association, and positions that they've taken to keep an extremely low hourly rate as a basic rate for people working in restaurants.
No, that's part of the issue. That's in the forum. So the issue opens with essentially a discussion or a roundtable with some experts from various parts of the food system who were addressing the question of how can we make the food system more equitable and more sustainable. And so one of the things that was brought up was labor. And if we want to make the food system equitable, how we treat farm workers and how we treat restaurant workers is really important. And so, you know, many listeners, I assume, would be familiar with Fight for 15 and the fact that there really has been this surge in organizing to make sure that people who serve our food can support their families and support themselves. And, you know, we have this really antiquated system where the minimum wage in many states for tipped workers is much, much lower than the regular minimum wage.
It's like $2, isn't it? Or $2.15, something ridiculously low price.
Yeah, $2.13, yeah. And that's actually, you know, that's a holdover essentially from just the initial post-slavery period where Southern restaurants were looking for free labor, essentially. And so it's a really unjust system, and it may be that some restaurant workers are able to definitely make more within the minimum wage if they're working in a expensive market at a high-end restaurant and they have enough hours and they work good hours. But imagine that you are a waitress at a Waffle House and you work the overnight shift in a small town with very few customers. How can you expect reliably to make more than minimum wage with your tips? And of course, restaurants are supposed to make up the gap if there's a gap, but there's very poor oversight for that. And so it's just a ridiculous system. People work very hard in the industry and aren't able to get by. And so I think one of the things that this writer pointed out was that in order to fix the system, we have to confront the power of the National Restaurant Association. It's a big corporate lobbying group, and they have a lot of sway, particularly in Trump's Washington. And so that's a fight that a campaign that people can get invested in if they're interested in that issue.
Well, you know, that's a good transition to where you are. You're in Washington, D.C., and so you're seeing a lot of issues right now, and there's so many things that people would like to be addressing. I'm curious, do you see any reason to be optimistic?
Well, when it comes to the food system, I think my reasons for optimism are largely outside of Washington. And I think there really is a renewed interest in trying to find more sustainable ways to farm. I think that story about Kernza is a good example where, organic hasn't really changed many commodity crops because organic mostly applies to fruits and vegetables, though of course not entirely. But when you look at the acreage of farmland, so much is devoted to grain. And so I think this impulse to think bigger and think about how to make the way that we grow grain more sustainable, I find that very hopeful. There are lots of young farmers who are interested in farming again, or young people who are interested in farming. And of course, there are many barriers to an entry to farming, from land prices to citizenship requirements that stop a lot of our best farm workers who are immigrants from actually owning land. There are those barriers, but I think the fact that people are interested in growing food is a really positive sign. And then, you know, there are these organizing campaigns around fair treatment for farm workers, around immigrants' rights, around restaurant industry labor that have really gained power. And although the political climate is fairly hostile to that organizing right now, there have also been significant victories at the city and the state level. And I think we're going to continue to see more of that activism.
Is there still a way for somebody that's a farm organization or farmers or people in the food system that would like to encourage the nation to do coverage of a certain area, a certain issue? How can they bring that to your attention to consider, you know, future story ideas?
Well, you can find me on Twitter, and my Twitter has links to my email and my website, and people can reach out to me that way. I'm always happy to hear story ideas. And we also have a submission page. If you go to thenation.com/submissions, that's a form that you can send story pitches to. And that, I mean, that's meant for writers. So if you have an idea for a story that you think you should cover, I encourage people to reach out to me directly.
Now I'm curious how this whole project has affected you. Has it changed any way you think about eating or what you're eating or how you're relating to food as a part of your life, of going through this process of several months and hearing all these different stories and all these ways of looking at the food system? What effect has it had on you?
Well, it definitely made me hunger. You know, I had to stop working on these articles late in the afternoon because it got impossible to work on them without going to get a snack. From a more serious level, I definitely think more about the complexity of food now, and I've become a lot more interested in the political conversations that chefs are having. And that's something that we didn't really get a chance to cover in this issue, but I think there is a conversation that's growing about who is getting credit for food, what kinds of food are we celebrating, who is actually doing the work to grow the food and pick the food and cook it, and how are they being treated. And I think thinking about all of those social and cultural and political layers behind a meal is really fascinating. It's important, but it's also just interesting. And so I think I have become, just more fascinated by food from doing this issue. My background is mostly in environmental and health, which obviously has a lot to do with food. And I think I've become much more aware of the cultural conversation about food through doing this issue.
How did you get into this? How did you become a writer employed by The Nation?
Well, I studied writing and political science in college. I went to school in the Hudson Valley, and I was an intern at The Nation shortly after I graduated. And so that was my entry point to journalism. And The Nation's internship, for any young listeners out there, is I think a really excellent program. It's very hands-on. You're not just getting coffee or making people copies. It's really learning how a magazine works from the inside, how reporting works. And so I was very lucky to get into that internship program.
And then from that, you had some other writing responsibilities, and today you find you're an editor, a writer with The Nation. And
that's
somebody
right, yeah.
That thinks about food maybe three times a day, if you're one of those that still eat three meals a day.
I do. I like to cook. I like to eat. I grew up in a rural part of Oregon where, you know, there wasn't really any place to go out to eat. So cooking and eating was definitely something that was part of the daily rhythm of family life for me when I was growing up.
So what's your favorite food?
Oh, man. I don't have a favorite, but I can say that right now I've been getting really interested in sourdough bread and making my own bread.
Oh, wow.
And that's really interesting because no two loaves are the same, and so I'm having fun experimenting with that.
Oh, you're making me hungry. Well, listen, I want to congratulate you. I think that you've done an excellent job of pulling stories together, and I think we can be reassured that when you're doing the sourdough bread now or enjoying food, you're thinking about it. And actually, that's one of the things I hope to accomplish with doing this podcast, is have people think about how the food gets to the table. And you've done a good job, I think, in pointing it out that it's not only the farmer and the scientist and the companies and the restaurants, but it's also the people that are bringing it to your table, too. And I think if people slow down and think about all of that, you're to be thanked.
Well, I really appreciate your interest.
Zoe, thanks for being on Farm to Table Talk.
Sure. Thanks for having me.
You've been listening to Farm to Table Talk with your host, Roger Wasson.